Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
There is a place where time stands still. Where nature is harsh and demanding. Where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Cook it in the guts, Barry.
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
did you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Good morning, everybody. Yes, this is Annie for Showreel, 3CR's look at the Australian film industry. And of course, as the wonderful Talk Back With Attitude hosts and producers have said, reminded you, MIFF, Melbourne International Film Festival, is still running and it's full of wonderful and exciting films. Everyone that I've seen has been very diverting and some terribly amusing laugh out loud movies. But one film called The Incomers, which was set in an island off the coast of Scotland. Two people who are a brother and sister who are going to be evicted. Absolutely hysterical film. Wonderful and heartwarming as well. Plenty of other things to look at. Make sure that you have a check it out. You know, even if you just see one film, you'll be pleasantly surprised at the variety that's being shown at MIFF. Some of them will get releases, but not all of them do. And as a previous program people said, you know, there's a huge variety of films from different countries, which is always really exciting to see how the other people see the world and how other people make films, because they're not all the same. Anyway, today we're going to go to a very small part of a session that was done by Documentary Australia. Documentary Australia does a whole range of very interesting sessions, very practical, focused on practical skills and support for filmmakers, Australian filmmakers. If you haven't ever looked at what they do and you're a filmmaker, and would pay you to have a look, because there's some very interesting stuff. And part of their Advancing Impact program, that's what they call it, they had a wonderful seminar about distribution and audience pathways for social impact. Yes, it's a mouthful. But Chris Kamen gave an incredibly insightful and practical look at what a filmmaker should do or consider when they're getting themselves ready to make a film, thinking about the impact and distribution part and how important it is right at the beginning, even as they're trying to collect the money for the project that they're working on. Anyway, I gleaned a little bit out of the session. You can find the full session on Documentary Australia's website if you go looking. But this is just a small part of it. This is about the distribution landscape and the importance of thinking about distribution and impact at the financing stage. We're going to hear a little bit about that, and then we'll have a little break, and then we'll hear about a case study that he was involved in, a small distribution process for something that was called Small is Beautiful. And it's a fantastic sort of hands-on approach. Now, Chris Kamen is the producer of Casimir Burgess's Iron Winter. He was also involved in the Casimir's earlier film. We'll hear a little bit more about the practicalities of distribution.
It's become very globalised. So for a long time, Australia was kind of more sealed off from the rest of the world. We had our own local Australian ecosystems, probably driven a lot by local broadcasters like SBS and ABC for documentaries in particular. You know, SBS and ABC are under budget pressure. They don't have as much money to commission as much documentaries as they used to. And then, of course, audiences have largely moved to streaming, and it's dominated by the big global streamers. YouTube is now the world's biggest streaming platform. And of course, you know, you've got your Netflixes and whatnot. And sadly, they don't seem to be interested in commissioning Australian docos. So, you know, that traditional pathway is very difficult because of the move from a local to more of a global environment that we're working in. But that has opportunities, of course. The other trend, COVID obviously supercharged the whole transition to streaming and move to a globalized streaming kind of model. But because we're now in a much more global environment, the big streamers are looking for like fewer titles but have global appeal, and so rather than many titles that had local appeal, and that has budget implications. So we talk about it as like an erosion of the middle. So mid-budget level that a lot of Australian documentary makers lived off has really fallen away. So now you've either got really low budget stuff, you know, YouTube model basically, or you've got super high end premium, you know, got to compete on the global level, and there's not much in between. So for filmmakers' career advancement, it's really difficult to jump that gap from making stuff for free, you know, making stuff in your own SLR for YouTube. How do you bridge that gap from there to up and to compete at the global level? It's a real challenge for us professionally and from a business perspective. I think how it looks on the commissioning side, where, you know, the traditional idea of like making something for a broadcaster or a streamer, but then on like the theatrical documentary side of making something that would kind of launch in a cinema, that's also tricky. And I think our recent experience in Iron Winter, we might talk about this, but the festival circuit around the world, in Australia and around the world, the festival scene seems to be really popular. Like it's a really, I don't think festivals have ever been stronger. There's so many of them, and they're really, you know, largely doing really well. And people love going out as a cultural event to go out, get out of their house and go watch something at the Melbourne Film Festival or the Sydney Film Festival. But what doesn't seem to be translating anymore is how that then goes into a theatrical run. So when film finishes its festival circuit, it might do really well on the festival circuit, but then that doesn't necessarily translate into results at a box office for a conventional theatrical release. So for quality factual, I'm finding better quality factual on YouTube these days than our public broadcasters.
Wow. I'm really interested in this relationship between the story that you want to tell and how you get it financed, and then how you take it to an audience. So absolutely, let's talk about some different ways of financing a film and how distribution and finance work together.
Yeah, absolutely. The best advisor I ever got was Chris Oliver Taylor, who's a senior, you know, in the filmmaking community. He was CEO at Matchbox Pictures at the time, and he sat me down when I was trying to make Franklin. And it's like, listen, like, no matter how good your idea is, your producer's core job is to figure out how you're going to get this thing made. So when you look at kind of how finance plans work, I think there's three different models in Australia for how we make things. So I think the kind of the main model that you think of when you start filmmaking is like the commission-led model, where you're looking to pitch an idea to a broadcaster or a streamer, and they will pay you, the filmmaker, to make that film or a series. Because they're paying for it, they will have the creative rights. They will have approval rights over what you actually, you know, you're making a product for them to their specification. Like it's your idea, but they will tell you what they like about the idea, and they'll have, you know, approval rights over, you know, the fine details of how you actually make it. So that's a key thing to think about. And also, obviously, because that broadcaster or streamer is paying up front for the project, they're going to have first dibs at how to get that out to the world. So obviously, broadcaster, streamer, they're going to put it on their TV channel or their streaming platform. But there's also a whole lot of kind of knock-on effects of where you can put that film, where else you can put it. And then the other kind of separate way to make films in Australia, I struggle to find the best name for this. I call it the investment-led model. And what I mean by that is filmmakers raise money, they raise finance from either investors or philanthropists or crowdfunding, like basically raise money any way you can with the intention to then use that money to make a film. When you finish the film, then you go out and you monetize it. So there's no one paying you a big amount of money up front to make the film like a broadcaster or a streamer does. So that's the big difference. The idea is that if it's a great film and it's a hit, it'll make lots of money, and those investors who gave you the money, they will earn a return. But the key thing is the way in which that is distributed is not necessarily predetermined in the same way that like a broadcaster distribution is definitely predetermined, because a broadcaster is paying you to make and they're going to put it on the on their channel. But with an investment-led model, typically it would go into cinemas first, because that's kind of how movies are traditionally distributed, and they go through all the different, the windows we call them. Still, there is a model in Australia where you have to do that. You have to do a cinema first release. But there are also increasingly other ways to do it. And we should add grants in there too. So, we have a very generous funding system in Australia with Screen Australia and our state-based funding agencies. They all give us free money. They give us grants that go into our finance plans. There's certain rules. If they're giving you a lot of money, like Screen Australia, if they're giving you more than $500,000, then they actually become an investor and they own a share of the project. Whereas if they're giving you in traditionally documentary, we get less than $500,000. So it comes as a grant, which means we can retain ownership of it. So it's still an investment though, because as a producer, we're pooling this money and we're creating an asset that we're then going to monetize and try and make money out of down the track. You can do this with or without a distributor, and that has implications for how much you can raise, but also how it's distributed. So this investment-led model is a lot more distribution agnostic, potentially. And then the third model that I would like to touch on today, and I'm not a specialist in this area because I haven't made a successful YouTube channel myself, but I know some friends who have, and it's really interesting to see how YouTube and like the creator economy has emerged as a viable pathway for especially, I think, new entrants to the industry. If you can crack the business model of the creator economy, it can actually be a lot more viable and sustainable for you as a practitioner than the first two models, because the first two models are project by project based models. So it's one film at a time, and it's stupid because it's like a startup. Every time we make a film, we're starting a new business from scratch, which is a really inefficient way to do things, kind of. But as filmmakers, we like to move from one project to another. Like, I've done Franklin, done Iron Winter, worked on other films, and they're completely separate films, different audiences. And as a filmmaker, I like to be able to move through different subject areas and look at different stories. Whereas with the creator economy, it's a completely different idea where you're committing to one, like building up a channel on YouTube or building up a brand really across multiple platforms. You're building up something and it takes years, and you're not just making one thing, you're obviously making lots of videos and lots of films. But if you can sustain that, if you can maintain interest to keep doing that, it can actually become a really good business. This model is a commission-led where you're taking a brilliant idea to a streamer or a broadcaster and you're saying, "I've got a great idea for a show, da da da," and they're like, "We love it. Here's a quarter of your budget," and they will com that's their commission. So that's like, in this case, we're looking at around $250,000 for like an hour, and in exchange for that, they're going to get a bunch of rights, which we'll go into. And yeah, to distinguish between a commission versus a pre-sale versus an acquisition, they're kind of different things. So commission is the big amount of money up front where they kind of really have a sense of ownership in investing in, like, putting money into your project to make it happen, and they want it for their station or their streamer. Whereas an acquisition is where you've made the film and then you go into them after the fact and you go, "Hey, I've made this film, would you like to put it on your TV station?" And they probably give you $5,000 for it. That's kind of or like 20 grand is kind of the going rate for how much you can expect from an acquisition from an Australian broadcaster. And then in the middle is like a pre-sale, which is kind of like, it can be a bit ill-defined, I find, but generally it's halfway between a commission and an acquisition where they're coming on, it's before you've made the thing. So the pre-sale is the money will go into your finance plan to help you make the thing. But it won't be as much as a commission, but it'll be more than an acquisition. And it may or may not have editorial strings attached. So like they may or may not have approval rights over the thing. So typically what you would normally do is like the producer in Australia would go to an Australian broadcaster and get the commission from like an ABC or SBS, let's say, and then you might go overseas to seek pre-sales. So you might go over to like PBS in the US, or you might go to Arte and ask them just for a pre-sale. So it's a smaller amount of money, and they're not the lead commissioning broadcaster. So it's more like they're just going to get what they get, and they're not going to have as much input into what the whole idea is. So you got the commission, brilliant, and then you can go get your producer offset. So the producer offset is this tax law which gives you an automatic refund on the money that you spend. So for TV and streaming, it's a 30% rebate. So for every dollar you spend, every QAPE, they call it qualifying Australian production expenditure, and there's just a whole bunch of rules about what kind of spending is eligible, but in a nutshell, you don't get your full 30%. It's a bit less than that, probably more like in your low 20s for the 30% offset. So that's an automatic amount of money that you get at the end of your production, and so you have to get a loan from somebody in the meantime to give you this money to actually make your film. So that's where you need lawyers and experienced producers to navigate all of that side of things. So that's wonderful that we have that government support and it's automatic.
It comes at the end. The film is finished and delivered and
that's right.
audited. So it's a rebate that comes back to you at the end, and that's why you need to cash flow it in order to get the film made.
Yeah, so you need to get a loan, and there's specific, you know, offset lenders that will lend you this money, at an interest rate. Or, you know, some producers have got enough money they can fund it themselves and earn some interest off their own money. So that can be a good, tidy little business. With Screen Australia, we can apply for funding, but there's a couple of different ways. There's a couple of different strands. So if you look up Screen Australia website, you've got Producer First, which is, we'll talk about that in a minute, and Platform First is when you've got a commission and there's rules, there's eligibility rules about you have to have a certain amount of money from that broadcaster or streamer, that from that commission, in order to be eligible for that fund. If you are eligible, then it's a kind of like a special budget, you know, a special pot of money, or not even that. It's a surer bet to get your funding. It's easier to get that funding than it is if you don't have a commission.
It's what they will often call marketplace attachment, which
that's right.
Also can refer to having a distributor attached,
marketplace. But under this commission-led finance plan, you'd be looking to apply under that platform first strand, as opposed to the producer first strand, which we'll touch on next. And then you might go and get, you know, like a top up, so some funding from a state-based funding agency. So, you know, New Screen New South Wales or Vic Screen or Screen West, Screen Queensland. And once you've got all these pieces of the pie together, you're left with a gap. The last 10 to 20% of your finance plan is always the hardest, because you've kind of got all these other easier, quote unquote, easier sources of money. And so then you have to get really creative with how you're going to close your gap. And for a commission-led finance plan, you might be chasing those overseas pre-sales, or you might get a commission. Like I've worked on some projects where you have multiple commissioning partners. They call them co-productions, like in Europe, and where you've got PBS in America give you a commission, like, you know, $200,000 or $300,000. And then you might go to Arte and they might also give you a couple of $100,000. So they're both like full commissions. It can be a juggle though, because they both expect editorial input and editorial approval. So how are you going to make sure that they're on the same page with the film that you're making? So that can be a bit of a tightrope to walk for a producer. Actually, Vitamania, one of the films I worked on back in with Sonia Pemberton at Gene Pool. Sonia was brilliant at strategically thinking about that. She made a version, Vitamania was made for an Australian audience for SBS. And then there were certain scenes that she reshot in France for Arte in France. And it really just helps the film have that local flavor that the broadcasters are wanting, especially more and more now in a globalized marketplace. Those national broadcasters, they want their commissions to be really local to distinguish from the global content. So you need to like localize it more and more now in that regard. Another really common way to fill your gap is to get a distribution advance from a distributor. So, you know, there are TV specialist distributors where, you know, because when you get an Australian commission, traditionally they just take the rights to show that in Australia, because you know ABC only has a footprint in Australia and the Pacific, but they would only show your show in Australia, and so therefore the rest of the world is up for grabs, and you can get a distributor who would give you a bunch of money as an advance against future revenue that you're going to earn off that. And so that's the key thing to keep in mind with the distribution advance, is that it's actually your money as a filmmaker. It's your future revenue is what they're giving you. Of course, they're risking their money because they're having to give it to you up front so you can make your thing. But you always got to keep in mind, it's actually your own money that you're borrowing. You know, it's like borrowing against yourself in the future, so that when that distributor does take it out and sell it all around the world, they're going to be paying themselves back that advance. It's kind of like a loan. They're like paying them back that, plus they pay their commission. They pay themselves a commission for their own fee, and then they recoup that advance out of the producer's share, the filmmaker's share of the revenue split. So that at the end of the day often leaves producers looking at their royalty statements going, where's the money gone? Because it's all disappeared. The other way to fill the gap is for the producer to kind of reinvest some of their fee that they're earning out of the budget back into the finance plan.
Which has become, unfortunately, more and more common.
So as we've discussed, so when in under this model, your broadcaster streamer will take they'll take exclusive rights for TV and VOD. Like even if you're getting, you know, like because all the broadcasters now have their own streaming platforms. So, you know, you get something up with SBS or ABC, they will take TV rights as well as streaming rights for Australia. And then they will also impose a holdback against you exercising the other rights. And so what I mean by that, and that's holdback is the industry jargon for like, you know, ABCs and SBSs or Stans, they want it to premiere on their platform. So they don't want you to put it into cinemas. So there's a holdback in the contract. There'll be a holdback preventing you from putting it anywhere else until they've broadcast it. And there also might be like a 1 year or 2 year holdback. And this is all part of the negotiation of like, you're not allowed to put it up on YouTube for a certain amount of time or that kind of stuff. So, because they're trying to preserve the value of their investment into their show for their own platforms. And they don't want you to put it other places.
My name's Nicholas Rothall. I've directed this film Undermined, Tales from the Kimberley. You're listening to 3CR.
And you are. You're listening to Annie on Showreel. And if you thought that making a film or a documentary film was easy, just listening to how a producer would gather together the money, as Chris Kamen, who was the producer for Casimir Berger's Iron Winter and other films, is explaining, it's a pretty complicated affair. The other voice that you're hearing is Dr. Mitzi Goldman. She's from Documentary Australia. And we're hearing a small part of a webinar that they put forward as part of their Advancing Impact program. If you're a filmmaker, it would pay you to listen to some of the stuff or become involved in some of the webinars that Documentary Australia is putting out. We're just going to finish off with a case study that Chris puts forward. It's a small case study of a particular film called Small is Beautiful.
Going back in time to 2015 was when I was kind of much earlier in my career. And this is I'll do a really fast case study on Small is Beautiful. So Small is Beautiful was a feature documentary that we made on more like $100,000. And basically that meant we only had a small fee, and we only paid ourselves after the fact, because we were basically... It was a situation where Jeremy, the filmmaker, the director, was a wedding photographer, and he had his own DSLR, and he was a successful wedding photographer. He would go make lots of money over the wedding season in Australia and then go travel the world over winter. It was great. And when one trip he was going through America, and he discovered this burgeoning tiny house movement where people were building these amazing tiny houses, and he thought that would make a great film. So he started filming. It was as simple as that. And then he kind of got halfway through that and then realized he needed the producer. So he came to me and we kind of worked together. We got really entrepreneurial with that. And it was a really kind of good fun as like a first time feature. So much lower budget. He did a small crowdfunding campaign. And the objective for the crowdfunding campaign on that one was not so much to raise money for the feature, but he was doing it more as like a litmus test to see whether people were interested in this story. So what he did is he just made a short film He made like a short 2 or 3 minute film, put it on Vimeo. It got selected as a staff pick for Vimeo. And he's like, maybe there's interest in this. And then he did a little crowdfunding campaign, and he only tried to raise $5,000, but he did it as a test to see if like this had legs, and it went really well. He raised $7,000, or no, maybe $10,000, somewhere in that realm. And then that kind of gave him the confidence just to put the rest of his own money into it. So that's how he self-financed that. So distribution implications of this is that there were none. We had freedom because there was no distributor, there was no pre-sale, there's no one putting money up front. We weren't obligated to deliver anything. But on the flip side, it was entirely on us. We had to self-distribute because nobody else was ready to receive this product. We had to go and figure out how we're going to get to an audience ourselves. So we did our own pop-up cinema release. We in Brunswick in Melbourne, Hipster Central, who are people who are interested in tiny houses in that neighborhood. We hired a warehouse. I've got a friend who runs an AV business, and we set up a cinema. It was great fun. And we built a bar, and we got beer sponsorship, and we were selling beers as a business thing. So like we were really trying to be entrepreneurial and figure out how to make it work. And we totally vertically integrated. We owned the cinema, we owned the bar and the candy bar, and we owned the film and the distribution. So we only did about a week's worth of screenings, but it was profitable. So it was good fun. So that's kind of what we call by four-walling. Like four-walling is jargon for when you just hire a space to screen the film in. So it could be a cinema that you hire, but you're just paying like a rental fee to use the space, and then you show the film in and you can sell tickets and keep the money.
Mm-hmm.
We did cinema on demand, which I think is becoming a bit of it's kind of died out a bit. I mean, I think Film Fan Force is still going, but I won't go too much into that. But basically the idea is a website, people can request your film to be in their local cinema, and if you get enough people pre-buying tickets, then the screening goes ahead. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting, innovative way to do it. We self-released onto VOD, so we put it onto like Apple. This was back in 2015, so kind of just as Netflix was taking off, but you know, it's where Apple Movies was a lot more common way to like buy or rent movies. So we launched on that. And then we eventually did sell to Netflix, which is great. And so by the time we sold to Netflix,
you're in profit.
Jeremy had made his money back. And that was like, in terms of like, you know, what is success? That was success for this film, is for Jeremy. He put his life savings into this to get paid his money back. And then he quit film. He's like, this is a terrible business. And he's gone off into digital marketing and he's doing really well. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that some of the lowest budget films that I've made more profit on than the higher budget films that I've made.
Yeah.
Really, it's a lot of work, not going to lie, but you can make more, you know, sometimes, as I said at the beginning, the barrier to entry is lower. And if you're prepared to do a lot yourself and to get a small team around you it's a great way to learn.
And that's it for Showreel this morning. Coming up next is Published or Not. We'll go out with a very cute number from the band, the number one band, Closer.
I'm gonna get closer to the ground. I'm gonna lie real still without a sound. I'm gonna put my head down in the fading light. Feel the movement of the small beasts as they prepare for the night. I'm gonna get my heartbeat down real low, so it's beating as the world turns and I say slow. Keep my mouth shut, I got nothing to say.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.